I think it would be disastrous for all of us if that was the case. I think hopefully with these strikes, the public support that we've gained, the government will listen and see that that just isn't, you know, isn't an option. People don't want to lose the NHS.
If gestures of support by passing motorists is anything to go by, public support for the strikers is strong. It remains to be seen which side the British government will decide to be on. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The closing session of the 9th meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe was held in Tehran. During the meeting, the two sides stressed the importance of bilateral cooperation in the fields of agriculture, health, and facilitating exports of Iranian drugs into the Zimbabwean market. Iran and Zimbabwe officials agreed to use Iran's experiences in various fields, including the development of small and medium-sized enterprises, energy, and science.
Agriculture, exports of machinery, sale of petrochemical products, and technical engineering services are among the existing capacities for broader cooperation between Iran and Zimbabwe.
Speaking at the meeting, Iran's Minister of Cooperatives, Labor and Social Welfare, Soled Mortazavi, said that the current level of commercial and economic relations between the two sides should increase to at least $500 million per year, based on high potentials of the two countries.
The current level of commercial and economic relations between the two countries is not satisfactory, and the two countries should use their capacities to increase their volume of bilateral trade to at least $500 million per year. Zimbabwe has been under sanctions for almost 20 years, and Iran can share its experiences with Zimbabwe in various fields, including neutralizing the existing sanctions of the West.
Addressing the meeting, the visiting Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Makamura Shava, said mutual ties with Iran is taken to be very significant for Zimbabwe, stressing the country will definitely enjoy bilateral friendly ties with the Islamic Republic.
Zimbabwe and Iran are like twins who must learn to cooperate, because both countries have been slammed with sanctions by the West. And in this regard, the West hoped that Iran would go to its knees, Zimbabwe would go to its knees, but thank God this has not happened. So we are here to make sure that we turn the fortunes round and to say that these sanctions which the West imposed on us can be a blessing in disguise.
At the end of the meeting, several memoranda of understanding were signed by the two sides. According to Iranian officials, sanctions have become an opportunity to enhance production and improve human resources productivity, and that Iran is ready to transfer know-how and develop Zimbabwe's energy, transportation, tourism, medicine, and mining sectors. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Pakistanis take to the streets across the country on Kashmir Solidarity Day to condemn what they call the illegal occupation of Jammu and Kashmir regions by India. The rallies were held along with a host of events, including conferences and seminars, attended by senior government officials and lawmakers in such major cities as Lahore, Karachi, and Islamabad. Kashmir Solidarity Day is marked in Pakistan every year on February 5. The day marks the nation's renewed commitment to the people of Indian-administered Kashmir. Participants in the rallies demanded the UN Security Council to implement its resolutions on Kashmiris' right to self-determination and end what they called the bloodshed in the Indian-administered Jammu and Kashmir.
Observance of Solidarity Day on February 5 is proof of Pakistan's continued support for Kashmiris. We will never accept India's occupation of Jammu and Kashmir and will continue our struggle for the independence of the Kashmiri people.
The purpose of celebrating the day is to renew the pledge that the people of Pakistan will continue to provide moral, political, and diplomatic support to their Kashmiri brothers and sisters until the independence of Indian-occupied Kashmir.
Kashmir, a Muslim-majority region, is divided into Indian and Pakistani sections, but claimed by both in full. The Kashmir dispute has led to several wars between the nuclear-armed rivals since Pakistan's independence in 1947.
The United Nations should play its role in ending the decades-long sufferings of Kashmiris who are struggling for their right to self-determination. The world should urge India to hold composite and meaningful dialogues with all the stakeholders to resolve the dispute.
Relations between India and Pakistan worsened in 2019 when the Indian government revoked Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, which granted Indian administered Kashmir partial autonomy.
Islamabad has long argued that Kashmir should have acceded to Pakistan because of its Muslim majority population. However, the court response from India in this regard has put the matter on hold. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
South Korean families of the victims of the crowd crush that killed 159 mostly young people last Halloween gathered at the memorial in Itaewon on Saturday to mark 100 days since the tragedy. They demand a thorough independent probe and accountability.
We definitely need to know the reason why our children died here last October 29th. I think the only thing we can do for our sons and daughters who left this world for no reason is to hold those responsible and punish them.
Demonstrators marched from the memorial past the presidential office. 11 emergency calls were made in the hours before the disaster. Local officials knew tens of thousands would gather in Itaewon, but crowd control was not implemented. Still, the safety minister said the deaths could not have been prevented, angering family members. One investigation has led to a handful of indictments of police on duty and low-level officials, but top officials have been spared.
Naturally, it is the President, the Minister of the Interior and Safety, and the Commissioner of the National Police Agency who are obliged to take responsibility for the lives and safety of citizens. But from the beginning, right after the disaster, they sought to avoid responsibility, and politicians continue to insult the families and victims.
City Hall denied the marchers access to the nearby plaza for their demonstration, as the fallout from the tragedy turns ever more political. 26 foreigners died in the crowd crush last Halloween. Five of those were young Iranian exchange students. And as the families and their supporters seek justice, they face harassment and official indifference. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The political crisis deepens in Peru, where the legislative body has rejected President Dina Boluarte's bid to move elections to this year. Congress shelved the bill due to objections raised in a meeting of the Constitutional Committee on Friday. The matter is unlikely to be discussed before July when Congress begins its new session. Lawmakers had previously agreed to move the date of the elections from 2026 to April 2024, but it could not calm the protesters. Boluarte thinks the reschedule of the voting to this year might help mitigate unrest and chaos. The South American country has been in the grip of unrest since early December. There have been frequent clashes between protesters and police in several cities, almost on a daily basis. Confrontations have resulted in dozens of deaths. Apart from early elections, Peruvian protesters also demand President Boluarte step down.
We are outraged by the injustice that is happening, by the police repression, by the deaths, by the lack of justice, also because the people are demanding the resignation of the president.
However, Boluarte has defied the calls accusing those demanding her resignation of pursuing political blackmail.
My resignation is not at stake in this situation. There is a minority of the population, of these groups that are generating violence and chaos in the country, who are pushing for my resignation in a blackmailing manner. And we are not going to give in to this political blackmail.
The protests have also taken a heavy toll on the country's economy, with workers being hit hard.
The unrest has negatively affected the export of goods and the operation at key mines, which are major sources of income for the Andean nation. The protesters around the country have blocked highways, causing shortages of food, fuel, and other essentials in several regions. Hundreds of trucks remain stranded at the border with Bolivia, awaiting the end of a strike called by the protesters.
We are suffering every day. There's nothing to eat. Look how the roads are. You can't even walk, no motorcycle, no car, nothing. Dina Boluarte's government do not pay attention to what the people are demanding. What more do they want? How many more deaths?
Peru's unrest has been propelled mainly by indigenous people from the south. That's where ousted President Pedro Castillo comes from. He was removed from office and arrested in early December as he was attempting to shutter Congress to stave off his impeachment. The demonstrators demand his release because they regard Castillo as the one who can fight poverty and inequality. It seems that the fundamental problems driving the unrest will not go away, as the protesters are not only angry over stark inequality, but they feel neglected by state institutions, especially Congress, which many Peruvians say are being run by corrupt lobbies and vested interests.
The recent decision by the European Central Bank to raise interest rates by a further 0.5% has thrown Italian families and small and medium entrepreneurs into the depths of gloom. Prices in Italy rose 8.1% year-on-year in 2022, hitting a 37-year high. Now, Italians see themselves stuck between a rock and a hard place. The country's inflation rate had shot up to around 12% in the months between October and December, a trend also seen across Europe. This is due to soaring energy and food prices linked primarily to the conflict in Ukraine and the related rearmament spending that all members of the bloc are engaged in. But it's also caused by the governments having thrown support packages worth hundreds of billions of euros at the corporations and the rich over the past years.
High inflation, soaring energy bills are biting hard. In addition to that, our average salaries have not kept up pace, and they have not gone up for years. It's really worrying.
Quite simply, I went to buy food at the supermarket last week and the items I usually buy for 30 euros cost me about 50 euros instead.
Although inflation rates have recorded a clear abatement across Europe, Italy is still dealing with two-digit inflation, which stands at over 10%. The European Central Bank's latest rate hike has brought to 3% the total of interest rate increases over the past 6 months. The EU's governing council is expected to raise them further next month.
These moves by the ECB adopted to slow inflation don't seem to have worked very much so far. The problems affecting our economy seem to be rather structural, and this situation has led citizens and businesses to lose confidence in a real recovery.
According to a survey of some 27,000 citizens commissioned by the European Parliament, more than 9 out of 10 of Europeans are very concerned about the rising cost of living. 40% of the people living in the EU feel they are already struggling to pay for food and other basics, and almost one in two says the standard of living has fallen. But more worryingly, they are not holding out much hope for the future, either, as another 39% expect the standard of living to fall this year. Max Civili, Rome.
The 53rd exhibition of Iran's nuclear industry achievements was inaugurated in Tehran on Thursday. The event showcases the latest nuclear products made in Iran. Attended by head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, the expo put on display different applications of the nuclear sector, from centrifuges to radiopharmaceuticals and particle accelerators.
Despite all external pressures, we have managed to advance our nuclear sector, and this expo shows a small part of it. Today, we have become self-sufficient in nuclear fuel, radio medicine, and many other fields such as heavy water.
In recent years, Iran has been trying to diversify the applications of its nuclear sector. Besides power generation, the country is now focusing on particle accelerators for food irradiation and radiotherapy.
Irradiation systems are being built in Iran on a national scale. This will allow the country to irradiate all its food and agricultural products. This way, we can reduce food waste, ensure food security for our people, and enhance our agricultural exports.
Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry in 2006, it has constantly been targeted by sanctions over what the West calls fears of a nuclear bomb, something which Tehran categorically rejects, saying its nuclear program is civilian and peaceful.
As you know, the West has long been leading a psychological campaign against Iran's nuclear activity, accusing Iran of pursuing non-peaceful purposes. So we hold this exhibition for our people to see for themselves that our nuclear program is peaceful.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reinstatement of sanctions against Tehran in 2018, Iran took retaliatory steps by scaling back its commitments to the pact. The Vienna discussions between Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal, which aimed to revive the accord, have remained stalled since August last year. This, as Tehran says, it will come back to full compliance only if Washington removes all its sanctions. By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions cannot disrupt its nuclear program. At the same time, the AEOI says it will continue to build up the country's nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Black Lives Matter. This is a popular slogan we often come across in the streets of the United States following the fatal shooting and beating to death of African Americans there. That began with the racially motivated killing of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, among others. Anger and shock once again prevail as American protesters march their cities to denounce police brutalities and demand justice for another victim, 29-year-old Tyre Nichols. The man was beaten to death by a group of officers in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, after he was stopped for a traffic violation in early January. Nichols was in confusion as to why he had been stopped, but before he could know, the cops started kicking, punching, and pepper spraying him while he was crying for help. Nichols was pronounced dead in a hospital 3 days later. Activists are still in disbelief on how the police could treat a member of the society like Nichols as an enemy in the battlefield.
Here I am now, in 2023, and I'm looking at another video, this in color, where I'm seeing another black man being beat to death. Rodney didn't die. This is worse. It's beat to death with no mercy on no crime that they can even find that he had committed.
Here at Nichols' funeral, his family desperately called for an end to police brutality against the African-American community. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, who was also present at the funeral, slammed the killing and talked about an act that has a slim chance of getting passed in the Congress. Ironically, U.S. officials have turned up on such occasions in the past and made similar promises, but to no avail. Figures show that police brutality remained as rampant as it had been in the previous years. Law enforcement killed nearly 1,200 people, or about 100 people a month last year, making it the deadliest for police violence. Repeated shooting and lack of transparency have already terrorized America's black community. Many believe the reoccurrence of the brutal scene cannot be prevented by just suspending culprits. No African American will truly become safe from police brutality until its root causes are identified and dealt with.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the rising status of women after the Islamic Revolution. The Islamic Revolution in Iran has had considerable achievements in many fields, including with regards to women. In this program, we examine the rising status of Iranian women after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Please stay with us. Because of the importance of women in society and in social contexts, the enemies of the Islamic Revolution have orchestrated propaganda campaigns against the Islamic Republic, focusing in particular on the role of women and trying to belittle their role in the Islamic Republic. Despite this propaganda campaign, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has clearly stated that, "With regards to women, we claim the moral high ground, and we challenge and we question how the West treats women. Women are systematically exploited in Western societies. Women are mistreated and belittled in the West. They are treated as objects and their status is low." One of the achievements of the Islamic Revolution has been the solving of the conundrum of how not to limit and exploit women. In the Pahlavi era, during the reigns of the first and second Pahlavi monarchs, one of the most common problems faced by working women, especially Muslim women in Iran, was how to safeguard and preserve their dignity and status in different social contexts and as working women. Sadly, the monarchs and the ruling elite supported the Western viewpoint with regards to exploitation of women. But after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, women played a full role in the social, cultural, scientific, industrial, and sporting arenas, with their dignity and status safeguarded by the laws of the land. Another achievement of the Islamic Revolution was the presentation of clear role models for Iranian women. Before the revolution, in the Pahlavi era, the regime sought to supplant religion and religious values with a hodgepodge, a confused mixture of ideas drawn from ancient Iranian history and Western values. This strategy, of course, did not work, since it did not correspond to the reality of Iranian society. Iranian women had no successful role models to emulate, either in the context of the West or in the context of ancient Iranian history. Gradually, an identity crisis developed in the country. But after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, successful role models such as Prophet Muhammad's daughter, Hazrat Fatimah Zahra, peace be upon her, and Prophet Muhammad's granddaughter, Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, were presented to Iranian women. The status of Iranian women rose after the Islamic Revolution, and deservedly so. About 70 years ago, the French existentialist philosopher, writer, social theorist, and feminist activist Simone Lucie Ernestine de Beauvoir published her famous book, The Second Sex. The book is said to mark the beginning of the second wave of feminism in the West. In her book, Simone de Beauvoir argues that throughout history, women have become classified as the other, which has allowed women to remain oppressed. She advocates for their liberation. Her book, The Second Sex, is a 1,000-page critique of the patriarchal Western society and the idea that women were considered to be lesser beings than men. Simone de Beauvoir famously writes, "One is not born a woman, but becomes one in Western society," suggesting that gender is a societal construct and not a biological identifier. Throughout The Second Sex, Her famous book, Simone de Beauvoir, references ancient creation myths and the Bible, arguing that women are labelled as the other and thought to be secondary to men. She argues men defined women as the other, the darker, inferior side of humanity, unworthy of responsibility. In order to rectify this shortcoming, de Beauvoir questions the whole concept of sexuality and gender. A very similar point of view about women was held by the ruling elite in Iran before the Islamic Revolution. But after the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, women were viewed not as the second sex or the inferior sex, but rather as delicate human beings and as equals to men in all social fields. Thus, women are regarded as equal to men and play their rightful role in Islamic Iran on a par with men. Official statistics show that before the Islamic Revolution, 35% of Iranian women were literate, that is, they were able to read and write, and 29% of university students were female. About 37% of school pupils were girls. These figures were greatly improved with the advent of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Today, 99.3% of Iranian women are literate, and 60% of Iranian university students are female. Today, 43% of Iranian civil servants are female. Women make up 43% of employees in the government sector. From a total of 2.4 million jobs in the government-owned sector in Iran, 1.1 million jobs are filled by women. Clearly, the huge increase in the number of women university graduates in Iran has had a considerable impact on Iran's economy, with many top jobs in Iranian industry, academia, and business now being occupied by women. Iranian women were given the right to vote in 1962, but before the Islamic Revolution, few women exercised this right and their participation in elections, for example, parliamentary elections, was very limited. But today, about 17% of those who have been elected to the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, are women, and the average participation of women in presidential, parliamentary and local elections in Iran is about 55.9%, a very respectable figure. In his recent meeting with women from all walks of life, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, emphasized that today women can be seen among top Iranian industrialists, top Iranian scientists, engineers, researchers, professors, doctors and surgeons. Whereas before the Islamic Revolution, only a handful of such women existed. The leader poignantly added, "All this progress has occurred after the Islamic Revolution. The status of women has gone up tremendously, and we see huge numbers of successful women in business, academia and industry. In sports too, about 16,100 sporting clubs are active specifically for women in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iranian women have managed to win a total of 3,302 medals in various sporting events post-Islamic Revolution. 51 women have been elected or appointed as the head or deputy head of sporting federations in Iran, and 70 women have headed sporting delegations at the provincial level. This is quite an achievement for Iranian women.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's a once-in-a-century disaster that is gut-wrenching to surely make any human shiver due to the depth of the calamity, an earthquake that has taken away so many lives in two countries, Turkey and Syria. Devastation and deaths have occurred in both of those countries, yet one country is receiving more attention and aid, Turkey over Syria. Aren't they both a victim of this natural disaster? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at this angle of this horrible incident and why the U.S. and some of its allies, like Israel, have offered to help Syria, even though they have been responsible for the previous devastation through their war on Syria, not to mention sanctions. This is while Israel has continued to bomb Syria.
Search and rescue efforts are underway in Turkey and Syria after two massive earthquakes rattled large swathes of the two neighboring countries and left thousands dead. Rescuers are digging through piles of the rubble to find possible survivors. But the freezing weather conditions is not only hampering rescue operations, but adding misery to those who left injured or homeless. Concerns are particularly high over the situation in Syria. The natural disaster has multiplied the tragedy Syrians have been going through for over a decade. The devastating quake brings to the spotlight how difficult life has been for millions of those who were displaced by foreign-backed militancy and endured Western sanctions. The crippling curbs have devastated Syria's economy to the extent that the country is unable to recover and reconstruct by its own. Now the same unlawful sanctions are complicating international efforts to assist Syrians who have been affected by the latest quakes. The World Health Organization says Syria's humanitarian needs are the highest, describing the situation as a crisis on top of multiple crises.
WHO recognizes Turkey's strong capacity to respond and considers that the main unmet needs may be in Syria in the immediate and midterm.
That assessment is echoed by other UN officials as well as rescue workers on the ground in northern Syria.
Those people already needed assistance. Now they will need more of that assistance, and they need an immediate earthquake-related assistance.
Honestly, the situation is very disastrous. It needs the interference of United Nations organizations and international organizations that are specialized in rescuing, because the situation is very harsh and people are still under the rubble from yesterday.
British activist Vanessa Bealey, who is now in Syria, says the Western sanctions could target anybody who comes to Syria's assistance.
The people who are now homeless are in the streets soaking wet and freezing cold without any alternative shelter and without any electricity, without any heating, without any fuel, because of course we don't have any heating fuel either in the country pretty much. So these shortages combined of course with the Western barbaric sanctions, including the CESAR law that was imposed by the Trump administration, which penalizes any country that even comes to the assistance of Syria. So those countries that can then be sanctioned by default if they come to the aid of Syria, which is, you know, a criminal sanctions regime to impose on any country and quite unprecedented.
Now the Syrian Red Crescent has appealed to Western countries to lift sanctions and provide aid to help the Arab country deal with the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes. The humanitarian organization has also urged the United Nations to facilitate the aid effort, particularly in the militants-held area in northwestern Syria. It says they are ready to deliver relief to those areas if militants open a road for them. The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said the quick-hit areas may need years to recover from the destruction. It says long-term help will be needed and not just assistance in search and rescue operation for survivors.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Eliza Magnier is a journalist and political analyst who joins us from Brussels. Also joining us, Edward Horgan, peace activist and former UN peacekeeper, who joins us from Limerick over in Ireland. Gentlemen, welcome. Eliza Magnier, I will start with you. And this is quite a bit of stat in terms of the message it sends, and I'm wondering why this is the way it is. And that's concerning foreign aid, where you have 5,000 deaths, or maybe over that amount at this point, that have died because of the devastating earthquakes in both countries, Turkey and Syria, 3,000 in Turkey, roughly, and 2,000 in Syria. And then you have 65 countries who have pledged aid for Turkey, yet five countries for Syria. What do you think the story is there?
Thank you for having me. Syria has been since many years, even before the beginning of the war in 2011. And with the Caesar Act that was imposed unilaterally and unlawfully by the US and the EU to cripple the population, in theory, should not include the humanitarian aid. However, as we have seen the case with Cuba, with Iran, with Syria, Venezuela, particularly during the COVID-19 and much before, where humanitarian aids are not excluded from the sanctions that are imposed by the US and the EU. Moreover, there are no countries around the world that dare to challenge the US by sending their plane to Damascus, except a few, like Iran sent 40 to 45 tons of support. Iraq is doing the same. Emirati will send some more, Algeria, Tunisia, and many other countries promised to send support to Syria. However, by seeing 74 nations supporting Turkey and only 5 to 7 countries sending their humanitarian support is something fundamentally wrong, because according to the UN Charter, there are no differences between an enemy or a friend when it comes to natural disaster. So when we see the fake, the hypocrisy, and the double standard of the West talking about human rights, generally speaking, but their behavior in Syria when they see only what's happening in Turkey and try to close an eye about what's happening in Syria is unacceptable, because there are thousands of people under the debris. Syria is not capable of supporting these people in this case of natural disaster. Throughout the war, there were 38 hospitals that were destroyed. 700 doctors have been killed by the jihadists and all the allies of the West that have interfered in Syria. And also the United Nations is not moving. The international international organization are not encouraging each other to go to Syria and support the population as they are doing rightly in Turkey. But as you said, there are plus 2,000 people under the debris killed in Syria, and there are much more still when the Syrian government is unable to reach them. There are mass graves that are created on the spot in many villages in Syria in the north, close to Gaziantep. And all this is a catastrophic disaster that humanity is really closing an eye or turning the head and looking the other way.
Well, let me ask you what you think, Edward Horgan, about what the U.S. has said. When it comes to Turkey, the U.S. has said it can count on it for anything that it needs in the aftermath of this quake. In terms of Syria, this is what the U.S. has said. Ned Price, quote, "It would be quite ironic, if not even counterproductive, for us to reach out to a government that has brutalized its people over the course of a dozen years. This is a regime that has never shown any inclination to put the welfare, the well-being, the interests of its people first." I've noticed plenty of scenes, as I'm sure you have, and I'm sure that government spokesperson has seen, including U.S. officials, of children under the rubble in Syria being pulled out.
and many to have ended up in hospital beds that have died later on. And yet they come out and they make this type of statement. What do you think about their stance regarding this?
Yeah, I think it's very hypocritical of the U.S., considering what the U.S. and its allies did in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Iraq, and in Syria and Yemen. The sanctions in particular are being imposed primarily by the U.S. and the European Union. Sanctions imposed in circumstances like this kill people. I would call immediately for all sanctions on Syria to be removed and for all countries to give as much aid as possible to Turkey and a similar amount to Syria. I visited Aleppo with an Irish peace group in 2017. I saw the devastation that had been caused in Aleppo then. Clearly, a large area of northwestern Syria had been very severely damaged, and humanitarian emergency needs to be addressed. So very clearly, the sanctions imposed by the US, European Union and others are now causing very severe damage. Also, the US is at the moment in illegal occupation of part of northeastern Syria. It has at least 900 troops. Likewise, Turkey is also illegally occupying part of northwestern Syria. These countries shouldn't be interfering directly in Syria. And now, in the middle of this crisis, it's vital that a huge amount of humanitarian effort is needed, not only in Turkey, but equally in Syria.
The war on Syria that has lasted, even to this day, really, in a sense, Elijah Magnier, needs to be put into perspective when it comes to the way that it's dealing with this devastation through the earthquake and what it has done. And one personal recount here is how a Syrian was found dead in his bed. This is a person that's recounting this. A Syrian was found dead in his bed this past winter because he had no heating. Why? Because U.S. sanctions are hurting ordinary people rather than Bashar al-Assad's government, because there's only an hour or so of electricity per day. This war has reduced this country to such a low level of infrastructure capacity that it's dealing with this type of situation. Surely, when this earthquake hit, as we're speaking, there are patients arriving at the hospitals that don't have the machinery, nor the equipment, nor the medicine, because of sanctions and also because of the war devastation, to deal with people. Again, these are all knock-on effects, which ultimately leads to people dying. Isn't that a one way of looking at what has happened to Syria in the lens of this earthquake?
Yes.
Well, we know from...
This is for Elijah Magnier. I'm sorry, Edward. I'll get to you in a minute. Go ahead, Elijah.
We know from President Joe Biden himself when he said sanctions are not made to change the government. They made to attack the well-being of the population. Such a statement made by Joe Biden directed to Russia can be directed to Cuba, to Iran, 43 years under sanctions, to Venezuela, to Syria, to Lebanon, to the Palestinians. All these people who have been under harsh U.S. sanctions because they don't accept the U.S. terms and they do not submit to the U.S. hegemony, according to the U.S. understanding of human rights, the U.S. is not looking after the population. On the contrary, it's seriously contributing in the killing of the population. When there is 1 hour of electricity in Syria, 2 hours in Lebanon, it's because in Syria, it's only Iran is feeding the country with oil, while the Americans are stealing the oil in the north. And I'm not inventing anything. It's President Donald Trump who said, I want to take the Syrian oil. And then Joe Biden just followed exactly the same policy as Donald Trump, which means that the objective is to cripple the Syrian government, to cripple the Syrian population, to starve the Syrian population, exactly what they are doing in Yemen too. And they really don't care. The end result for them is all justified. These people submit their lure, or they have to suffer. This is what Mike Pompeo said about the Iranian. They want to eat, they have to come to the U.S. So what's happening in Syria is that been going on for the last 3-4 years, and that, if we don't count all the years of war that was waged against the Syrian government to create a failed state and allow the jihadists to take over the country, because for the U.S. and the West and NATO, the jihadists are more preferable to be in the Levant rather than President Assad and the Syrian who voted for the president. So it is obvious that the West is watching the Syrian dying, and they really can't be careless about it, because their objective is completely different, is not related to the human right, and is not related to the well-being of the population.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Edward Horgan, when you take a look at, first of all, why is Syria still under sanctions? Isn't that war supposed to be over in a sense? I mean, what is the U.S. trying to achieve when it has already done what it did a few years back, the most severe sanctions being the Caesar Act that it leveled against the country, which means nobody can get close to the country to do any type of trade? That's not even working. You even have U.S. allies who are now back in the game with Syria and the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, like the UAE, like even the Arab League that's opening itself up, like Jordan, and other Arab countries that are possibly in the works to get back together with Syria again. So that puts into question what the U.S. is after.
Yes, the sanctions are having the most devastating effect, in particular on the most vulnerable people, the children and the elderly and those who are already ill. So this, it's vital that the sanctions be removed as quickly as possible, and that as much aid is sent into Syria, into all parts of Syria. Probably the largest area affected is the both the city and the province of Aleppo, and areas controlled by the Syrian government. And it's very likely that the sanctions will prevent much of the aid from getting to the people who need it most. Sanctions kill people, and especially in Syria, and many more people will die because of the sanctions, in addition to the devastation that has been caused by the earthquakes. So it's vital that the sanctions be removed as quickly as possible. Also, only the United Nations should be allowed to impose sanctions. Arguably, the sanctions imposed by the US and the European Union are in contravention of international law because of the damage they are causing and the people they are killing.
There's a provision that the UN has that I'm almost sure that you're familiar with this, Elijah Magnier. It's called R2P, the right to protect. And that was what NATO used, in essence, when it attacked Libya, because it accused the Libyan government pretty much violating the rights of the people of Libya. And that was the basis, which we saw how that turned out. Now, is it correct to analyze and then compare that being law by the UN for there to be a motion towards what is happening now to remove these harsh sanctions, which are in essence killing Syrians? And now we're seeing that a natural disaster like an earthquake has compounded the deaths of people. In a sense, it's just like what the R2P sounds like, the right to protect. The Syrians need that. Can there be any motion towards that on the international arena?
Yeah, and then when NATO, when the United Nations agreed on the resolution, it was very specifically stating that it is to the protection of the civilians. The problem is the United Nations can issue any law or any resolution, but then it is interpreted completely differently by the people and the countries who want to wage war and want to change and interpret the resolution in the way they want. And this is what happened in Libya. So we have to really look carefully and not overestimate what the United Nations resolutions are, because in the matter of Palestine, there are 178 resolutions that have never been respected. Therefore, the United Nations is no longer a viable body, international body that is respected. It is just a building with so many employees. But at the end of the day, who is falling back to the United Nations? The war in Iraq was not agreed by the United Nations and was against the United Nations. It was an illegal war. The sanctions against Syria are unilateral sanctions by the EU and the US. The sanction against Iran is only US sanctions, but who dares to violate these sanctions without the fear of paying the price and then be also sanctioned by the US? So it is a jungle law. We don't have a United Nations. We should really forget about what the United Nations are capable of, because they're not capable of anything. They are under the control of the West. And when the West is opposed by other superpower nations like Russia and China, then the revolution don't go forward. And then they go to war anyway, and they do whatever they want, and they don't care about the United Nations. So we don't have to look at this international body as a balancing the world and then looking really to the well-being of the nations and where the nations have a say. There is a bully of the world called the United States of America, and is saying, I do things my way, and if you don't accept,